It's sublime and ridiculous. I mean, we'd actually been in the same film, The Shipping News.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But I only shot for a week, and her bags were packed, and she came down into the foyer of the hotel as I was arriving with my bags. And I think we said something like, well, maybe we'll be in the same frame one day. And we sort of knew, had people in common, but no, this is the first time we'd worked.
Was it intimidating? Was it?
I was so excited. I mean, you jump at the opportunity to work with people like Judy, who are utterly peerless, and also she's so her technique is so well honed and incomparable, and her experience is so vast. And her humanity is so deep, but her technique is buried so as to be invisible, and so she makes it look effortless. And I think that the realization of a character like Barbara Covert, in a lesser actor's hands, could have been quite gauche and one-dimensional. And what she has done is allowed you into this sort of the exquisite sort of fragility and the desperate isolation and therefore the humanity in Barbara Covert, as well as, you know, the Machiavellian vampiric sides of her. And she's, you know, also hilarious and witty, and so she allows all of that, you know, the very black comedy to breathe. So I loved every second.
You've said that this is one of the most morally taxing things that you've ever done.
Poor me.
And also that you were quite shocked by your own sort of puritanical reaction to how you would go through the process. Can you elaborate on that at all?
Well, it's utterly beyond, and still is beyond, my comprehension. But I'm not interested in playing characters who are me. I mean, I'm drawn like a moth to a flame to the difference. I mean, it's that way is... Just on a selfish level, your sense of the scope of humanity is constantly expanded by encountering people who think differently to you. But once I conceived of Sheba as being somebody who was utterly lost and adrift, and therefore quite desperate, and the fact that she had sex with the boy in the summer house at the bottom of her garden, in full view of her husband in the bedroom, that woman is someone who wants to blow her life to smithereens. And then there was a window in for me. But personally, I mean, I don't know what you talk about with a 15-year-old. And once someone opens their mouth, no matter how gorgeous they are, if they start talking about rugby, it kind of kills it for me.
It could help them with their homework. When you get a script, you've had such an incredible career and such a wide range of roles. What is the process of scripts getting to you and your reaction to them? I mean, what gets you with a part? Because you've got a superb taste. Obviously.
Well, I sort of learned quite quickly through experience that a good script doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a good film. So the process really hasn't changed in the fact that it's always a leap of faith and on instinct. And it's about the conversation that you're going to have, isn't it? I mean, between you and the director and you and the other actors. In this particular instance, I'd read the book, and I'm friends with Patrick and Marba, and knew that he was writing the screenplay. And then it sort of went very quickly from there. I mean, parts like this don't come along very often. I mean, you have a lot of...
But you're in three movies right now, and they come along.
I'm terribly sorry.
No,
it was an unusual year. And I was exercising very different muscles in each film. I mean, you know, literally. I mean, I was lying on the floor covered in blood in Babel, and then in this high style in Good German, and then you have this kind of... hammer and tongs, fighting it out in the seventh circle of hell with Judi Dench. So it was, you know, they were quite different endeavours.
Have you got any more insight into why people would sabotage themselves in a situation like this, and do you think she did it because she was feeling smothered? Was it a grab at youth and vitality?
All of the above. I think it's so complicated. You know, and I think if she had 15 years on the analyst's couch, then she might find the language to sort of make conscious her deeply unconscious actions. I think it's interesting that the arm-stroking scene between Barbara and Sheba was a bit of a key, because I think Barbara's sense of her own sexuality is so adolescent and unformed, and I doubt whether Barbara Covert has ever had, you know, adult sex with anyone. So, say, to categorise her sexuality into any neat box is really difficult. And I think equally to categorise Sheba's emotional state is equally difficult. I mean, the fact that she had there's something cyclical about what she does, in that she was a student who married her teacher and sort of skipped her rebellious period and went straight into being a mother. But yet she had all this punk, she had this sort of, all this punk within her that didn't have any outlet. And I feel like there's an adolescent, oh, fuck it quality to what she does, that is utterly irresponsible. And it's almost like she hasn't, I don't know, I perceive that we acknowledge we age every 5 years, and it's almost like Sheba hasn't acknowledged that she's moved on from being 19, and she's suddenly in her, you know, middle 30s, and thinking, well, I'm not going to have any more children, and my husband's getting on, and this is actually the job that I thought was going to be fulfilling isn't. I want to fuck it all up and start again. But she's an adult, and
like a midlife crisis.
Yes, yes, yeah, I think so. And I think midlife crises are becoming earlier and earlier, given that, you know, old age is now considered 27.
And she has so much familial responsibilities with her child who's disabled, too. The crushing weight of that, I think, can make people react in ways that we can't even...
And Bill and I were just saying that this morning, that remembered when we were talking about why Sheba does what she does, that it was really important not to be able to attribute it to an unhappy marriage, because thereby I think the film would be trying to justify it. You know, she's unhappily married, so therefore, of course, she goes and sleeps with a 15-year-old boy. No. I mean, if you want to sort of get out of a relationship, which I don't think Sheba necessarily does, there are many, many ways of self-combusting that don't involve sex with a minor. There's a level of sort of exhibitionism, and I think the desire to be found out, that contains a very, you know, clear cry for help.
If she doesn't want to blow everything to smithereens, then why does she come back to Richard?
I think she has to. She emerges out the other side. But, you know, there were many, we thought of many, many ways of ending the film, you know, of Sheba walking up to the house and walking away, of her walking up and then not knocking, of her walking up to the house and not going in. And then we felt like the bravest option was her knocking the door. I don't think it's sentimental, because I don't think the film is saying in any stretch of the imagination that therefore it's okay, and think there is no solution or salve for the wound. I mean, the children are irrevocably damaged, as is their marriage, but I mean, I suppose that there's enough love there to try and, you know, salvage something out of the ashes.
Is your commitment to your theatrical enterprise in Sydney mean that henceforth you're only going to have time to do one film a year? You'll never have a run like this?
I think irrespective of whether my husband and I were taking over the Sydney Theatre Company, I may never have a run like this. I mean, I think a run of doing Babel, Notes on a Scandal and The Good German, I mean, roles like that rarely come up, but for them to come up in the 1 year, I mean, I'm a very small part of Babel, but, you know, it's something... No, I am. But I'm enormously proud to be part of it, and I wanted to be part of it because I felt like the scope and reach of the film was so powerful. You know, I'm not interested in how many lines I have. It's what the project is saying. But the charter of the Sydney Theatre Company is that it's run by an artist, whether it be a writer or a set designer or an actress. I mean, the current artistic director is an actress. My husband's a writer, and because it's run by an artist, the board decided, well, quite rightly, I think, that there's a a time, a slot out each year that you don't necessarily have to take, but is there for your own artistic development. Say Neil Armfield at Bourbon Street goes off and does operas in Vienna, and I think it's really important because I think you come back renewed and galvanized and have more to offer the company. And, you know, if Scorsese calls, I'll be free. But it's an enormous responsibility to run the company. There's four spaces, you know, the Opera House, the Sydney Theatre, and two spaces at the Wharf, plus the development arm and the educational wing of the company. It's a vast company. So it's, you know, we haven't accepted the role lightly.
So why do you?
Why? I felt when the offer came our way, I was sort of like a rabbit in the headlights, and then it just felt incredibly natural. I think all these, I'm very collaborative, I think, is the way I work as an actor, and the thought of doing it with my husband, who we work very well together, and we bounce off one another really well and complement one another very well. It just felt incredibly natural. All these latent qualities, I think, that I've been, unbeknownst to me, developing. You know, my understanding of text, working with other actors, working internationally, working in both mediums. I think the acceptance of the job felt that there was finally a focus beyond myself to which these skills could be harnessed, I felt. And I hope it proves to be that.
Well, the part of the film that really affected me, especially about Sheba, was her relationship with her disabled son. Which was very beautifully done. Did you do any research or looking into parents of severely disabled children? And how they...
It was great to spend time with Max's parents. You know, the Max being the boy who played
your son.
Yeah. And I'd spent a lot of time at the Spastic Society in Melbourne as a child, called Urella. So, I mean, it's something that I sort of grew up with. And, it's a very difficult thing for parents. I've got a friend who's got a very sick child at the moment, and, you know, she said, it's just you never think it's going to happen to you. And I think it does something quite profound to a marriage and to a family, and ultimately can be incredibly expansive for a family that is as kind of elastic and bohemian as the family that is in the film. But it does take its toll, and there's a lot of focus and energy required, and selfless dedication that's required on the part of the parents.
Right. I had a friend who was a little girl, who was a young woman who was a hunchback, and her mother just could never forgive herself for that child, and it sort of ate her. I mean, got enormously fat and was sick all the rest of her life, so she was not the invalid that everyone would think.
It's an interesting dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, between the mother and the daughter, and how I saw that
Freud
totally.
Freud would have a lot to say about
yes.
That. Yeah.
Can you ask a little bit about
kind of
helping Andrew, he talked about how it was collaborative and you really helped kind of prep him for, you know, what he had to do and kind of his
role. Oh, of course, I hope so.
Yeah.
He was fantastic. He was really game and really enthusiastic and very open. And I blushed my way through the entire experience. Yes, it was sort of an odd inversion. It was almost like he was saying, it's fine, it's all right. To me, but you know, he was fantastic. He was very bold, and then he went for it.
And Judy. the scenes you know the intimate scenes you had with her.
With Judy, I mean, they were thrilling. I think as the increasingly you don't get to play long scenes out in film. People shy away from dialogue and think, oh, the audience's attention span, this scene's too long, let's cut into it. And so it's so great when you do a scene like you do on stage and you get to play the whole arc of the thing. I mean, it's
like you did with Hedda.
Yeah, it's like a wave, and Patrick had written these long scenes which have many breaks and shifts and turns and about faces in them, and I mean, we all really relished that opportunity.
It's unusual, I think, to have a film where the supporting character actually travels more of an arc than the lead character.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the drama, I think that was the kind of the conundrum in the screenplay, is that the drama actually lies in Sheba's story, but yet it's told from Barbara's perspective. And so it was a matter of finding that balance, because I think traditionally voiceover can be a bit of a cop-out, really, and I'm not a great fan of it. But what is thrilling about this voiceover and why I love it is it's so intimate, because you hear things that are for no one else's ears, and it's a true expression of what goes in a private diary. So it's using it to the best, most intimate and powerful. Its purpose is perfect.
Did you only see the film in its final mixed form with the Philip Glass score on it? I was kind of wondering what it would have played like without Philip Glass, because Philip Glass works so well with it. I was just wondering what it might feel like.
I saw a very early cut of the film, which was vastly different to the film is now. Invariably, as first cuts are, you know, I think often you need to go off in a tangent that, you know, is like the opposite direction of where you end up to know. I mean, I find that as an actor, you need to go in the wrong direction before you know which is the right direction. And I saw that with a completely different score. And it definitely, music is a very powerful thing.